This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Earth Day edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And as you've come to expect, we Zoom in on Tuesday in order to air on Wednesday. But as we've come to do every single day for the last couple of months, and we'll continue to do between now and November of 2020, we begin with the words of Colonel Vindman when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing in 2019. As everything seems to be falling apart, and he kept assuring his father things would be all right. I just want to let you know they're not all right. They're not all right for the Vindmans. They're not all right for the Arnie Arnesons. And they're not all right for most of us in the United States, if not the world. So we hear the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
The show airs on Earth Day. It's 50th birthday for Earth Day. I'm thinking 1970, how old was I? I was about, I guess, 15 or 16 years old. And my parents were like rolling their eyes going, oh, that's just a hippie event. Well, that hippie event had 20 million people show up in practically every city and town across the United States. And as a result of that, I realized we have to spend this day talking about Earth Day, not only because it was a remarkable challenge to us as a country, but we changed ourselves and we actually had helped to change the world. There was an article at theconversation.com which immediately caught my attention. It was entitled, "The First Earth Day Was a Shot Heard Around the World." Joining us right now is an associate professor of global governance and the director of the Center for Governance and Sustainability at the John McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston, Maria Ivanova. And I want to welcome Maria to the program. How are you, Maria?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Arnie.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about 20 million people in 1970, everybody's out there. And then I read a couple of articles and I thought, oh my God, look what we did, Maria. We created the EPA, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Something 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 Act, the Toxic Substance Act. We created the Superfund. That government was so engaged and aware, and it wasn't this like one-shot deal. It was multifaceted. It sort of looked at the gestalt and said, what do we need to do? And I'm thinking, oh my God, government really mattered. And what was so exciting about your article was that it really was not just about us, but it really was about the world. So talk to me about this inspiration that happened in 1970 and how our leadership wasn't just about us, but we recognized that this was an international challenge and therefore we needed a universal response.
Thank you, Arnie. And indeed, it is a story that is not very common to talk about the United States as a leader in 1970 internationally. And Earth Day, many of the stories about Earth Day are just, they're wonderful. As you said, millions of people poured in the streets in the United States, 20 million, which actually was 10% of the US population at the time. And that is extraordinary. What would that mean today? But most of the stories are about how important that was for the United States. And that is true. it was critical. You mentioned all of the legislation, all of the institutions that the government at the time created, mind you, at the request, at the pressure of the people. But what also happened is that the government in the United States had now an idea that this needs to be done internationally. It's not only a US affair. And the statesmen and women who were at the State Department, at the Environmental Protection Agency that was created then, they had a vision that saw the Earth as the one planet that we have. And I mean, if you think you were alive at that time, but there was Earthrise, right? When people saw the planet as the little blue dot from Earth. And that was a really a turning point in world affairs, when we as humans could see the planet that we inhabit and the interconnectedness of all of its systems. And so I have to say that people who were in government in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s realized the interconnectedness of ecosystems, the interconnectedness of social systems, the interconnectedness of people. And they were the leaders internationally. So I have studied... I've studied this history in detail, but I've also had the privilege to actually talk with those people in person.
Wow.
And learn from them.
So I posted on Facebook because I said, who said this? And it's how you end your piece of the conversation. And I want to touch on that because in a way it continues the conversation we're having now. And this was the quote. What has dawned dramatically upon us in recent years is a new recognition that to a significant extent, man commands as well the very destiny of this planet where he lives and the destiny of all life upon it. We have even begun to see that these destinies are not many and separate at all, that in fact, they are indivisibly one. It's beautiful. And right. Richard Nixon said it. And Richard Nixon said it.
Wow. So
I isn't that amazing? I told you, Ken. I read that. I'm like, oh my God. But that's what I want people to understand, that the inspiration and the voices and the leaders were bipartisan. It was a Richard Nixon that all we really remember is Watergate. And what we have to remember is that there was so much more to him than this. And that those inspired words came from him. And they were not just words about the United States. They were words that really sort of led a world, Maria.
Absolutely. And this was in 1972. And this was for no particularly special big occasion. This was reporting to Congress on the creation of this new international agency, the United Nations Environment Program. And so this is the context, actually, in which Richard Nixon put the development of a new global agency for the environment.
Wow, unbelievable. So you said that you've had the privilege and honor of being able to talk to some of these people. So tell me some of the stories that they were able to share for you, because history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but as you and I both know, it rhymes. So I want to hear what they said. I want to hear about their inspiration. I keep looking at what's happening with the climate crisis, saying, are we prepared to sort of do the same kind of thing that we saw happen 50 years ago? And the difference, I think, between the climate crisis and what happened 50 years ago is that in a way, maybe they were luckier because pollution was so obvious. You know, it was so thick. It was so, the rivers were so polluted. You could touch it, you could smell it, you could see it, you couldn't breathe. Climate change is a little more amorphous. It feels, at least up until about now, it's been a little bit slower to be able to embrace. And yet maybe now, unfortunately, as we're watching the melting sea caps and we're beginning to see the ocean rise and we're beginning to see the extreme weather and what's happening in California, maybe what took, you know, 30 or 40 years to develop, where they were able to sort of see it immediately. But what did these people tell you, Maria, that really gave them both guidance, inspiration, and a sense that they could accomplish these things.
So you are absolutely right that at that time, you had smell, feel, touch problems.
Exactly.
You could smell them. You could see them. You could feel them. Yes, the Cuyahoga River was on fire in going through Cleveland in Ohio. And this is what Bill Ruckelshaus, the first administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, told me and a number of the people that I had convened in 2009 to actually bring together for the first time ever, and now it will be the only time ever, all five consecutive executive directors of the UN Environment Program. Wow. Because if there is one thing that I have learned through my research and through my work as a professor, it is that individuals matter. Individuals shape institutions. We always turn to the institutions, but those institutions, they do not appear by themselves. They are created by individuals.
So let me just stop you really quickly. Elizabeth Warren says over and over again, personnel is policy. Personnel is policy. And you are absolutely right by stressing the individuals. But so continue. But as you're saying it, I want to scream because people don't understand how important those individuals are, because they make the difference in what we see in the way policy is enacted, in what we see in the way there's a certain vibrancy to the result. But you're absolutely right. Those individuals matter.
Absolutely. And let me add to what Elizabeth Warren says, that personnel is the policy, by quoting another individual, Maurice Strong, who was the Secretary General of the first ever UN Conference on the Human Environment that convened in 1972, and the first Executive Director of this global environmental institution, UNEP, the UN Environment Program. And he said, from the very beginning in 1970, process is the policy. Process is the policy. And how is process made? By persons. And process means, how do you get people together? How do you work with them? And individuals matter. So what I wanted to say about the individuals is, yes, Bill Ruckelshaus, the first administrator of the EPA, said, yes, we had smell, feel, touch problems. It was maybe easier then. But the problems that we face today are equally visible. They may not be visible in the air in the same way, but you're right. We see the fires, we see the floods, but we also see the inequalities that people suffer. We see it in the eyes of the children today. We see it in the eyes of the poor that are suffering because of what is happening with climate change. I live in Dorchester, in one of the neighborhoods in Boston. When we had 6 feet of snow in 2013 and UMass Boston was closed for consecutive weeks, every Monday and Tuesday, I was at home. We had snow days. I know a lot of people who were stuck at home. They couldn't get to work. They didn't get paid. My salary as a professor continued. At that time, we didn't have online learning the same way we do now. But my heart goes out to the people who are affected by climate change, because when it snows 6 feet, it is the hourly workers that cannot go to work. It is their children who cannot go to daycare. And that is what we see today in climate change. And Christiana Figueres, another individual who is out there, she was one of the architects of the Paris Agreement. She is the one who is now one of the most ardent spokespeople for what is to be done on climate change.
You know, but again, and I want to touch on the other crisis we're facing, the pandemic. Because as you're talking about climate change, you're talking about the eyes and the experiences of the poor and the inequality that you see, where climate change really sort of harms them the most. And what we're seeing with the pandemic is, once again, that inequality is coming back because who is the most vulnerable? Who is dying? Who doesn't have access to the healthcare? Who has the pre-existing conditions? All those things. It's just so amazing that we don't understand how inequality touches every aspect, not only of our lives, but that inequality is played out in every single tragedy that we face, whether it was, you know, the Earth Day and pollution, whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's the pandemic, no matter what it is, the most vulnerable populations turn out to be the ones that are expendable, but they're not.
Absolutely not. So Arnie, what matters then in this case? What do we need? We need better government. This is my stance. We need better government. Exactly. And this is what we witnessed on Earth Day in 1970. Afterwards, in 1972, when the United States stood in Stockholm and advocated for a strong, leading environmental organization. And it was people in the US government who designed that international system. And people followed, the others followed. I write in my conversation article that Britain and France at that time opposed the conference. They opposed even the creation of such an organization, because if you remember, there was the Concorde.
Yeah, it that's was a banned. Plane, the big plane, right, right.
The yeah. supersonic plane.
Right.
And they were just starting it in 1969, and they thought and that international environmental regulations might hamper that. Today, the EU is a totally different player, right? Very much changed from that. But the United States at the time said, no, these are global problems. We have to create global solutions. And for that, what do we need? We need global institutions. And that has been the stance of the United States until the 1990s. And since then, the U.S. is exactly.
What was the turning point in the 1990s, Maria? What made us withdraw from a globalist kind of viewpoint?
I mean, different people will have different views. And so I came of age in the 1990s. I am a child of the fall of the Berlin Wall, right? That is when I was in high school, when the wall fell down. I am here in this country, in the United States, and now proudly a naturalized citizen because that wall fell and because it was possible to apply to colleges in the United States. So I came to Mount Holyoke in 1992 as part of the first group of Bulgarians to receive a full scholarship. And the way I went to Yale, that we talked about just a few minutes ago before the show, was because I received a full scholarship from Yale to be able to pursue my graduate studies. Mm-hmm. So that was a critical point in history. However, that was also a turning point in terms of neoliberalism and economic growth. And so a lot of governments saw economic growth as be-all and end-all and pursued it at all cost, in a sense, and kind of put the environment on the back burner. And then in 1994, there was a change in both houses, both Congress and the Senate. And this is what led to withdrawal of the United States from international activities and to a very drastic decrease of the funding that the United States contributed to the UN Environment Program, to UNEP, for example.
So you know what I'm thinking, Maria, as I'm listening to you, I keep thinking, well, we didn't step off the world stage. We saw the world in a very different way. Because when you look at the rise of multinational corporations and you look at the rise of that international opportunity to make a profit, what replaced the concern of being good stewards of the earth being good stewards of the environment. If that idea, and you mentioned it even in your article when you said that the French and the British were so upset because, oh my God, if we embraced environmental regulation, then we may not be able to fly our Concorde, okay? That should have been the warning sign, Maria. Uh-oh. And that we will do this interesting cost-benefit analysis, but unfortunately the cost-benefit analysis doesn't take in the gestalt of all the costs. What they look at is at the profit of the moment. And I will be honest with you. I mean, I ran for governor in 1992. Bill Clinton was a new Democrat. Bill Clinton sort of helped to drive that agenda because, you know, we blame what happened in 1994, but Bill Clinton was actually kind of a happier camper as a result of that because he was able to work very well with those conservatives and Republicans. But what was more defining for them was not stewardship. It was making a profit. And what we now see today, you know, in 2020, is look what we have as a result of all that drive and that internationalism to make a profit. And what we have is we don't have structures in place. We have an environment that's falling apart. We haven't made the rational investments. We have the greatest inequality in this country that we've ever had before. We have elected a leader who has no policy purpose at all. It's all about him. And I kind of look at this and I'm thinking, when we walked away from that sense of responsibility and stewardship, there was no one to fill that vacuum. No one stepped in. You're right about the EU doing its thing, but it didn't necessarily drive a world conversation the way we were able to do in the 1970s.
And I've been thinking quite a bit about that, the role of the United States as a global leader and what is necessary and what has to happen for the US to assume that leadership role. And could we have a global world order without that leadership? And right now, I don't know. It's a question to be researched. A lot of my students are grappling with this question at the moment, and it's kind of our collective research question. We would like to see the United States as the enlightened leader that it once was. Maybe this crisis can facilitate that kind of leadership. But what I'm seeing as a result of the crisis is a retreat to the national rather than an embrace of the global. And that worries me.
But I think the pandemic is also an opportunity to understand the global. This is not about the United States. This is not our disease. It is global in scope. It just like the pollution that didn't see boundaries between Canada and Mexico, or you would see the pollution coming in from other parts of the world. I think it really is reacquainting us with this idea of the planet and that we're in this together. And as we are frightened by the pandemic, we realize the solution can only happen if we act together. And what climate change has also shown us is that the only way we can fix this or address this or try to at least make it so that it's not so toxic is that we can't do it alone. And in a way, maybe the pandemic is a gift, as awful as it is, because it's kind of a refresher, you know, where that little blue dot was that you described at the beginning of the conversation. It turns out this virus is our blue dot. Isn't that amazing? Something that is so toxic could also be something that awakens us. You know, and maybe I'm just delightfully naive and incredibly hopeful. But I do think that between Donald Trump, who has sort of taken us to such an extreme, that there is an opportunity for us to sort of bounce back in a very, very different way. And I'm hoping that between the climate crisis and frankly the pandemic, it's kind of the bookends that sort of say, okay, now you work together. You have no choice.
I would like to see that happen. I would like to see a movement to work together. But this is where we need the individual leadership to transform into institutional leadership and state leadership in a global setting. So I would like to see the leadership in the United States, whatever that leadership is after in 2020. We need this country to step forward, take responsibility. Marianna, not take cover, but take responsibility.
So I'm going to just say something. I don't know anyone, in case Joe Biden does win, which I pray he does, I'm going to make sure that your name goes to him. Because your your voice, your clarity, your understanding, you know, where you came from, the opportunity that we presented to you, you are the best of what America is, but you're also the best of how the world should be. And I just think that these are the kinds of voices. I don't always want everyone that everybody knows. I want a Maria that they must know, because I think your voice is too important. And I would love to see, again, you as that personnel in order to affect that policy.
Thank you, Arnie. Let me just read you one sentence.
Okay.
In times past, our forefathers had the vision, but not the means to achieve such goals. Let it not be recorded that we were the first generation that had the means, but not the vision to make this dream come true. This is Richard Nixon in his State of the Union address in 1970.
I'm telling you, that Richard Nixon guy, he's going to make me crazy. I know. It's just, we keep saying it over and over again. We're like, oh my God, he wanted like the basic income. He wanted universal health care. He did the EPA. I'm thinking, how could such a flawed vessel be also such a remarkable thinker?
And the point is, Arnie, if we could do it then, yes, we must do it now. And we must do it together globally.
We will absolutely do this. But let me just share one thing. So Bruce Babbitt became an old friend of mine. And so Bruce Babbitt was a friend of mine. And Bruce Babbitt ran the Department of Interior for a number of years. And when I was running for Congress, he came to do an event for me. And what he did was he brought two pictures with him. Again, the beauty of the 1970s was pollution was so visible. Okay. And he brought a picture of the Merrimack River in 1968. And then a picture of the same exact place on the river in 1994. It was unbelievable. The 1968, you could almost see it bubbling. There was no life around it. The color of the water was nothing close to the color of water. It was, no one lived by that river, okay? And then the exact same location in 1994, 95 was shocking to see. And I would walk into every event with those two pictures and say, we can change things.
That's right.
We can make things better. This is our Merrimack River. You could smell it. You didn't want to be near it. Now look at it today. And I loved Bruce Babbitt because he gave me the visual that I needed to say that, as you point out, we need government. We need good government and we need good leaders. And that visual was so useful. So I as I was reading your article, I kept thinking of Bruce Babbitt and thinking, nice. God, I love those pictures, Bruce. Yeah.
Maria, the judge I used to clerk for was from New Hampshire, also from the North Country. And he used to tell me about how the Merrimack River coming through the White Mountains was different colors, literally different colors, because of the dye from the paper mills that were up north. It would be green, it would be red, incredible. It would be blue. Just like you said, the Cuyahoga was on fire. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say one other thing about government that would be worth some exploration and research by somebody maybe more of a political scientist. But, you know, the very same Richard Nixon, we talked about his pluses and minuses, his openness to environmental work and his obvious flaws. You know, Bill Ruckelshaus, who you were praising as the EPA director, you know, that's the same Bill Ruckelshaus who was the deputy at the Department of Justice when we had the Saturday Night Massacre. And Nixon fired Archie Cox as the special prosecutor, and Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, refused to fire him. And then the deputy attorney general was Bill Ruckelshaus. And he also had the character and the guts to refuse to fire special prosecutor. And the rest is history.
Well, yeah. He passed away last year.
Well, thank you so much. You are a delight. Keep writing for the conversation or just send me stuff and I'll get you back on. The title of the piece at the conversation was The First Earth Day Was a Shot Heard Around the World. Professor Maria Ivanova joins us, and I am so grateful, and I'm so glad that UMass Boston has you. They are so lucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, when we come back, we're continuing conversation about climate change, but now from the perspective of covering it as a journalist. Stick around. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 18-year-old Shia Bastida grew up in a small town outside Mexico City, where she saw the effects of both drought and flooding. Then, when she was 13, she moved to New York City and learned about the damage Hurricane Sandy caused there. She realized global warming affects communities all around the world and felt driven to do something about it.
When I saw the first global strike being called, I organized my school and I got 600 kids to walk out with me. I thought that 2 kids would walk out with me.
She says it helped her realize how many other young people are worried and ready to act. Since then, she's helped organize weekly youth climate strikes across the city. Now, because of the coronavirus, youth activists have taken their actions online. A long-planned Earth Day strike is being held digitally, with online teach-ins, virtual gatherings, and social media campaigns. Whether young people are on the streets or in cyberspace, Bastida says they bring a sense of energy and optimism to the climate movement.
Not in a way in which you are naive about the situation we are in, but just truly believing that when we come together, we can change the world.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1967. That was the day the Taylor Law went into effect in New York State. It was celebrated for granting public employees the right to organize and elect union representation. But it's also roundly criticized for stripping public sector workers of their right to strike. It was crafted and enacted in response to the militant, victorious New York City transit strike of January 1966. The Taylor Act amended key points of the 1947 Condon-Wadlin Act, which first prohibited public sector strikes in the aftermath of a teacher strike in Buffalo. But strikes persisted, and the act was seen as largely unenforceable. In the aftermath of the 1966 transit strike, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller appointed a committee chaired by labor relations professor George Taylor to make, quote, proposals for protecting the public against the disruptions of vital public services by illegal strikes, while at the same time protecting the rights of public employees. In addition to granting the right to organize, the Taylor Act also establishes impasse procedures for dispute resolution, defines and prohibits improper practices, prohibits strikes by public employees, and established the Public Employment Relations Board. But public sector unions argue the law gives no incentive for employers to settle disputes or negotiate contracts in a timely manner or in good faith. While public sector unions have struck since its enactment, Transport Workers Union 100 was subjected to harsh fines in both the 1980 and 2005 transit strikes. During the 2005 walkout, TWU 100 was issued a $1 million a day penalty, its automatic dues collection was suspended, and its leader Roger Toussaint was jailed for 10 days. The union continues to push for changes to the law.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Sulfur dioxide, hello, carbon monoxide, the air is everywhere. Breathe deep while you sleep, breathe deep, bless you, alcohol, bloodstream, save me, nicotine, lung steam, incense is in the air. Breathe deep while you sleep. Ectoplasm, fallout, atomic orgasm, vapor and fume at the stone of my tomb, breathing like a sullen perfume, eating at the stone of my tomb. Welcome, sulfur dioxide, hello.
Welcome back to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Earth Day edition. So now that we've talked about Earth Day, the shot heard around the world, we're going to talk about an article at The Nation. It was entitled, The Coronavirus Has Lessons for Journalists Covering the Climate Crisis. Earth Day's 50th anniversary serves as a moment to reflect on how to more rigorously cover the climate story. Now, Mark, is it Hertzegaard?
Hertzegaard.
Hertzegaard is the executive director of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism initiative committed to more and better coverage of the climate story. He is also the environment correspondent for The Nation and author of books including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Hot, you're absolutely right. So welcome to the program, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to me what you are now seeing with the idea of how to cover the climate crisis. Because I think the frustration we're seeing right now with the pandemic and COVID-19 is that part of the reason why we sort of love to turn to the governors and love to turn to the doctors and love to turn to the, is that facts matter, science matters. And even though we seem to be in an era where we sort of poo-poo science, suddenly because of the pandemic, we're not quite so sure that we shouldn't be valuing the medical people and shouldn't be valuing the scientists. So what are you learning from coronavirus that we can not only embrace as we cover the climate crisis, but understand that maybe even people may be more receptive to the kind of journalism that we need to see happening going forward, because the pandemic has really sort of put into sort of stark relief that you don't want to hear good news, you want to hear the facts.
I think fact-based reporting is the essence of responsible journalism. And the organization that I'm working with now, the Covering Climate Now, we're a global consortium of 400 news outlets across the US and around the world. Our combined audience of all those outlets is about 2 billion people. So it's quite a large size. And we've got some of the biggest names in news, very mainstream organizations, including Reuters News Agency and CBS News and Bloomberg and many, many more. You know, we pulled this together over the last year precisely because the climate story was not getting the attention that it needed. And one of the things that we have learned as we've been working with our colleagues throughout the media is that there was a lot of understanding that they needed to do more on climate change, but they literally didn't know where to start. And part of that was a lack of scientific, what I call scientific literacy in newsrooms. You know, I'll be blunt here. A lot of us as journalists, we didn't study science, right? We're humanities kids. And so we don't know math or science very well. And that's been one of the real problems with climate coverage, is that we have been bamboozled and taken in by a lot of the fossil fuel industry disinformation on that front, partly because they kind of took advantage of the scientific illiteracy in our business. I do think you're right, though, that the COVID-19 pandemic has, let's say, it's opened up a kind of a fault line within the media, where there are those of us who believe that, you know, you follow the facts wherever they go and you don't let your ideology get in the way of that. But of course, we see very strongly with the Fox News and Rush Limbaughs of the world that this pandemic has really revealed their contempt for science. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch going forward. How does the public respond to that? It appears that the early indications are that Americans are, the majority, the vast majority of Americans, are following and want to hear about the science. There is a very loud contingent on the right that is really not interested in the science. So I think, you know, the piece that we wrote in the Nation, and I should add that piece also ran in a Columbia Journalism Review. It wasn't just The Nation. We're the two co-founders of Covering Climate Now, and we say that really this pandemic is teaching us lessons as journalists that we also need to apply to covering climate. And the start of that is respect the science. Respect the science.
So let me
recognize that you have the ability to intervene to flatten the curve. And if you don't prepare for the impacts that are going to come anyway, you're going to be sorry.
Right. So I'm going to personalize this a little bit. So I'm very concerned about access to healthcare. And that was always that was the reason I became political back in the 1980s, was that I worked three jobs and never had insurance. Okay. And I went, this is nuts, you know? So I remember once going to Dartmouth Medical School and the doctors were bitching and moaning about something. And I looked at these physicians and I said, so where have you been on the policy front? Where have you been in politics? Where have you been writing these articles about all this knowledge that you haven't shared with the public? So part of my frustration, I think, is that you're right, a lot of the bad science or the science that came out of the oil and gas industry, there was a profit to that science. And while there were a lot of scientists that may have known that this was not fact-based or that it was massaged and that it wasn't really producing, wasn't giving us the true picture of what happened, I think the scientific community has also been a little bit reluctant to sort of leave their lab, okay? Leave their place within the university system to sort of convey the challenge and the urgency of the moment. Reporters cover what they hear. And if they only hear one thing, that's what they're gonna cover, Mark. And I think what has happened because of the climate crisis and because people are beginning to notice, and in part because of the pandemic, look at the doctors and the nurses that are stepping up. Look at the scientists that are stepping up. Look at the epidemiologists that are stepping up. I think this is important for us as journalists. We need something to cover, and we need something to be curious about, and we need to hear it as well. And I think everyone's suddenly realizing that they have a role to play, and you can't expect a journalist to ask a question unless you start the conversation.
I think we've seen that also on climate, though, increasingly.
Yes.
I mean, I've been covering climate change since the 1990s, and there was a great deal of reticence back then among scientists to speak out. Not all of them. I mean, Jim Hansen at NASA was a very notable exception there. But I spent a lot of my career overseas, and I know that every time I would come back to the United States, it seemed like the climate conversation in the media and in politics was about 10 years behind that in Europe. And that's partly because European scientists were a bit more comfortable speaking out. Now, 20 years later, I think it's much more accepted among scientists in the climate sphere to be speaking out. That's partly because they've gotten scared witless about just how far down the slope we've gone. And so you do have scientists like Michael Mann of Penn State and Catherine Hayhoe at Texas Tech and many others who are now speaking out very well. In fact, if people are interested, tomorrow on Earth Day, there will be a YouTube conversation between Greta Thunberg, of course, the Swedish teenager who's led the climate strikes, but with one of the world's foremost climate scientists, a man named Johan Rockström, who heads the Potsdam Climate Impact Institute in Germany. And they will be speaking, it'll be 6 a.m. Eastern time in the U.S., but that YouTube will still be posted, and we'll have it actually at our organization Covering Climate Now. And, you know, Rockström is a very good example of I think, the much greater emphasis that climate scientists are now putting on reaching the public. They realized that they were being, they were being too quiet, basically.
Yeah, and that is it is too quiet. I mean, when we were talking with our first guest, I mean, the beauty of Earth Day was that there were so many ways to touch people. They could taste it, they could touch it, they could feel it, they could see it. So in a lot of ways, all their senses were being impacted by what they saw from pollution, and therefore it wasn't just the scientists, but they could feel it. Climate change is a little more challenging. You know that, Mark. You know, and it's harder. First of all, I don't live where, you know, the ice caps are. So, you know, I can see a couple of pictures of it, and I can see some pictures of polar bears, but it isn't immediate in my life. And they can talk about, you know, the sea rising, but the sea rising, you know, after you were lucky, well, you weren't lucky, but if you lived with Hurricane Sandy, you got a sense of, wow, this is a really bad hurricane. Well, maybe one of the reasons why it was a really bad hurricane is because we are seeing the effects of sea level rise. But it's harder to be able to sort of touch people in all those different ways, which is another reason
there's
why.
There's no doubt about that.
Pardon me?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. In fact, oh. I say there's no doubt about that. Bill McKibben wrote a piece for us in The Nation yesterday where he talks about, he's talking about the importance of cutting off money to the fossil fuel industry. But he says part of the problem has been that compared to 50 years ago, when you could see the Cuyahoga River on fire, that climate change is invisible, is the word he used. It's invisible to most people because you can't see those CO2 atoms in the air. And you can see the impacts, but the impacts have to be, there you get back to the scientist role. You have to be able to say as a scientist, okay, Hurricane Sandy, yes, we see a climate footprint to that. And for many years, scientists, especially in the US, were overly reluctant to make those kinds of connections.
Well, you know, it's amazing because in a lot of ways, again, I'm going to say this again, maybe the pandemic is a gift in a horrific way. And that is, we're talking about climate change is not visible. Guess what? So is the virus not visible. And as that invisible virus has created such economic despair, such death, it comes in ways, it comes differently, it packages differently, it shows up differently depending on who you are, where you live, your age, your underlying health condition, all those inequality things that we know are impacted because of COVID-19. And what we know about climate change is that once again, inequality also impacts how you are harmed by climate change. And in an interesting way, the virus and the climate crisis are on parallel tracks, you know, and while we see 24/7 coverage, you know, pandemic, I'm glad you've got this, you know, new way of covering the climate crisis and that all these different organizations have come together, but we're gonna need something very similar to how we're covering the pandemic in order to get people to understand not only the urgency of the moment, but why we need to make dramatic change and that isn't something we can do. It's something we must do, Mark.
I think one of the big questions coming out of the pandemic overlaps directly with climate, which is we all know there's going to be a big federal stimulus program. There has to be to rescue the economy from going completely into the, you know, a repeat of the Great Depression of the 1930s. The question is not, is there going to be a stimulus program, but what kind of a stimulus program is it going to be? Is it going to be a green stimulus program that begins to lift us out of the climate crisis and point towards a new structure in the 21st century? Or is it going to be a stimulus program that basically tries to reinstate the status quo from the old century with fossil fuels and so forth? And that's going to be a story that all of us in covering climate now are going to be following very closely. In fact, some of our bigger outlets, such as Bloomberg, are already writing about how in Europe, for example, the European Union, pushed especially by Germany, is very much planning to make basically their equivalent to a Green New Deal as the stimulus coming out of the EU. South Korea, just day before yesterday, the ruling party approved a Green New Deal for South Korea. You can see in the United States, in the Democratic Party, that a Green New Deal was the de facto position of most of the presidential candidates, with the exception of Senator Biden, who's now the presumptive nominee. But even Biden is now moving farther in that direction because of two things. Basically, Bernie Sanders is pushing him and he needs Sanders supporters, but also Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, who was probably the strongest climate candidate. And Inslee's staff is now working directly with Biden's staff. So I think there's gonna be much more pressure in that direction. And of course, let's not forget that the oil industry is now imploding in a historic, unprecedented way.
I know.
And, you know, that creates all kinds of opportunities for different federal policies. So those are the kinds of news stories that we're hoping that at the nation, but also at Covering Climate Now more generally, that we'll be able to cover.
But so one of the things that we talked about with our first guest was that, you know, individuals matter. Policy is wonderful, but if you don't have the right people, then it won't make much of a difference. And you were a little, you know, we're a little bit frustrated with Joe Biden, and maybe Joe Biden wasn't there before, but maybe because, you know, of Inslee and because of Bernie, that maybe he will sort of, he will embrace the fact that he needs to make some really significant change. And I think he will, and Ken's heard me say this a million times, Joe Biden leads from behind. So now the question, who's in front? And I think
politicians, they respond that way too. I mean,
exactly.
It's a famous story that Franklin Roosevelt told during the Depression when some activist came in and said, Mr. President, you need to do X, Y, and Z. And he sat back and he listened. And he said, I agree with you entirely. Now go out and make me do it. By
yes.
which he said, go out and create enough political space for me as president to do this by creating public pressure. Because we have to remember that every president hears every day from the most powerful interests in the country, in the world. You know, that the CEO of Exxon, I guarantee you, is calling Donald Trump now to talk about
hysterical. This. Yes.
Every president has to pay attention to those powerful forces. And the only way that a president can really stand against them is if there's enough people out in the streets, which, by the way, is why Richard Nixon passed all of those environmental policies back in the 1970s, because he saw 20 million people in the streets on Earth Day 1970. That's what changed Nixon into an environmentalist. It wasn't like he was a tree hugger. He was a very shrewd politician who saw that there were people out in the streets, and he very deliberately decided he was going to take the environmental issue away from the Democrats in the 1972 election by passing a lot of legislation. Good. That's what democracy is supposed to be. So let's not worry about what Mr. Biden actually thinks. Go out into the streets and make him support a Green New Deal.
Well, you know, and again, I'm going to go back to what the pandemic has achieved for us. Not only is it invisible, like climate change to some extent, although climate change is now becoming a little more visible. But the other thing I think that's also fascinating is what the pandemic has done. It's all of a sudden we're not driving cars. We're not taking flights. We're all, you know, activity has completely, to a large extent, shut down. And I've said this over and over again on my radio show, and that is, my daughter lives in Shanghai, okay? And she said to me the other day, oh my God, I've never seen the sky before. Oh my God, I've never seen these vistas before. And all of a sudden people are seeing, you know, animal creatures they've never seen. They've seen birds they've never seen. They've seen, you know, the sky in a different way. They can breathe the air differently. And it, again, like pollution, all right, where you see the difference, but this has happened within weeks, Mark, within weeks. And what does that say about our impact on our environment, on our ability to change that environment, on the fact that we are responsible? Because in a short 2 or 3 months, you literally see almost 180 degree difference. And the only thing you can attribute it to is our behavior.
Yeah, a number of our news outlets are covering that story now. And I think it's having great impact on average people around the world. We have to be careful though, that we don't make it sound like the pandemic is some kind of a solution to the climate crisis.
That's exactly why
we need a Green New Deal,
right.
Is that we don't want to get environmental quality at the expense of all these millions, tens of millions of workers and families who are now in danger of bankruptcy and losing their homes and so forth. And there's no need to, because
right.
as a great piece in the Guardian newspaper yesterday, Guardian's our lead partner covering climate now, they talk about how a green stimulus can actually provide it's about the only thing, really, dealing with climate change is about the only project that is big enough to really lift the economy out of the depression that it's entering. So
Absolutely.
That's the direction we need to go. And I think that's what you're going to see more coverage of. It's certainly what we hope to be doing at The Nation and at Covering Climate Now. So I urge everybody to, I have to run off now to do another radio interview. So I'm going to just close by urging everybody, come and visit us at coveringclimatenow.org. And we appreciate your support.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, go to The Nation magazine or go to the Columbia Journalism Review, and you can sort of see both of your article in both. Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right, Chai. Bye-bye.
Folks are laying down their arms. Children and lovers wait with open arms. No more alarms. The creatures of the world are free. Clean are the waters and the air we breathe. It's not make-believe. Things can change degrees. They could be better than they've ever been. For you and me. Whoa, whoa. Things can change degrees. They could be better than we've ever seen in history. Doing the things that they should, all of the things that they know are really good. Yeah, it's understood. See the world with less of gray. See the fears of the people go away and stay away.